Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Anubis, Ancient Egypt's Lord of Death and Protection, by Charlie Larson. Foreword by Jason Miller. Narrated by Joe Hempel. Foreword. I am writing this foreword from a hospital room, recovering from one surgery and awaiting another. Everything went as hoped, and unless something unusual happens, I will be fine. The guy in the bed next to me didn't fare as well. He came in with some bone pain and just found out he has weeks to live. As I sit here considering what to write about this book, he is getting his finances in order and breaking the bad news to his friends and family. The presence of Anubis, great protector, weigher of souls and lord of death, is palpable in this place. Death is one of the few constants that bind us together. Every being ever born, from ancient Egypt to present-day America, dies. The universal mystery of death and what lies beyond is one of the first things that drew human attention to the world of spirit. For humans, at least, the indisputable fact of death seems to be accompanied by a sneaking suspicion that we continue to live on in some fashion. Some of us simply seek comfort in the face of the unknown. Some want guidance about how to live in a way that ensures a good afterlife. Some long for a Gnostic peak beyond the physical while they are still alive, while others, not satisfied with a peak, hunger for actual contact with powers they can petition and negotiate with, not only for a good death, but for a good life as well. Anubis is one such power. This book takes a deep dive into the history, mystery, and magic of Anubis, one that bridges the gap between the Nile Valley of 3000 BCE and wherever and whenever you happen to be listening to it. Charlie Larson invites us to cross that bridge and gives us the tools we need to do so. Many of the pagan books I was raised on went wide rather than deep when it came to deities and spirits. I have attended workshops where participants chanted the names of goddesses as if they were all just different versions of the same being. Isis, Astarte, Diana, Hecate, Demeter, and Kali were all thrown into a blender that yielded a bland spirit smoothie. Even today, students ask me if Hecate, a goddess to whom I have dedicated decades, isn't the same as Kali, Santa Muerta, and the Morrigan, since they are all dark goddesses. Thankfully, there are a host of newer books written by teachers who are fighting this tendency, delving deeper into the mysteries of a single deity. This is the first such book that I have seen on Anubis, and I am thankful to have it. This is not to say that deities don't overlap or are never synchronous. Charlie does an excellent job of explaining how the Greeks syncretized Anubis with Hermes to create Hermanubis, a deity worshipped during the Ptolemaic period and mentioned in alchemical and magical texts up through the Renaissance. Hermanubis, in turn, influenced early depictions of Saint Christopher, the saint of travelers, who was portrayed early on with the head of a dog. Does this mean that they are necessarily the same deities with different faces? Or does it essentially signal the birth of a new being? For me, the answer is yes, no, both, and neither. Given how subtle we humans can be, I expect vast spiritual powers can be even more subtle and hard to nail down. Thus, the mystery. Works like this are hard to get right. They have to be rooted in history, but not get trapped in recreating a cult that is no longer relevant to the time and place in which we live. As Charlie notes, we no longer mummify the dead, nor do we entomb them with all their riches. Just as devotion to Anubis changed in Egypt over the 3,000 years before the Common Era, it is only natural for it to have changed over the 2,000 years between then and now, and it will change over the next 2,000 years as well. In order for our practices to be relevant to our time and place, we need to establish fresh communications with the world of spirit. Of course, this has its risks. There is no shortage of pagans who report having received messages and visions from the gods, commonly called UPG, unverified personal gnosis. The quality of these communications varies widely, some descending to the level of personal fantasy or messages that are at odds with culture, with history, and with tradition. Unfortunately, these can disconnect us from spirit as much as they connect us. It requires a good deal of discernment to evaluate revelations from spirit in order to ensure that they are meaningful and actionable. But when these two poles of research and revelation are handled with respect and insight, something magical happens. They do more than just coexist. They harmonize and support each other. I am happy to say that this book does just that. It gives you the tools you need to make research and revelation rhyme. I won't keep you any longer. You have a book to listen to, and I am still in a hospital. Luckily, I will be released soon so that I can get on with my life. Thanks to this book, I hope to go about that with more of Anubis's wisdom under my belt so that, when the time comes, I will meet him with a heart lighter than a feather. May you do the same. Jason Miller, April 2024. Introduction. The day I first encountered Anubis began as just another nature adventure with my grandfather. It was a pretty regular occurrence for us to go hiking in the woods, watching birds and wildlife, looking for arrowheads out in the field, or simply driving around the countryside to see if we could find anything interesting. Even though I was only about 5 years old at the time, I can still remember many of the details of that day as if it were a realistic painting that has been pristinely preserved and cared for in a museum. It was a sunny autumn day in Indiana. The air was crisp and cool, but it was warm enough to spend time outdoors. There was a chance of rain, but the clouds still appeared to be far to the west. Many of the leaves had already fallen, but some of the trees were still holding out for one last colorful hurrah before the winter months ahead. The corn and soybean crops had already been harvested, leaving a view of the landscape for miles and miles. This particular day, we chose a wooded site just a few miles outside the small farming town where we lived. To my knowledge, the land wasn't owned by anyone in particular. There was a small, overgrown pathway just wide enough for a car that led back into the woods, perhaps the remnants of access to an old farmhouse that had once stood there. As we drove farther down the path and approached the woods, we came to a tiny wooden bridge that crossed a creek. It was barely wide enough for the car, and there were no rails to keep us from going over the edge. Because I was a particularly anxious child who was easily overwhelmed by anything that I perceived as threatening, my happy-to-spend-the-day-outdoors attitude quickly turned into anxiety, despite the fact that the bridge wasn't high enough above the creek to place us in any danger. Once across the bridge, my fear subsided, and we continued down the path, drawing closer and closer to the woods. My grandfather pointed out a tree that had been struck by lightning, a deep, prominent scar winding its way down the trunk, a detail that only added to my already edgy state of mind. He parked his navy blue station wagon, and we walked a short distance into the woods. The wooded areas in the middle of farmland in Indiana are not as expansive as those in the southern part of the state. Most in northwest central Indiana are small and patched randomly throughout the landscape. So it wasn't long before we came to a small clearing near the edge of the woods, with only a narrow line of trees separating them from a field. A noise from the field caused us both to stop. Suddenly, we spotted a deer just on the other side of the trees. It darted away as fast as its legs could carry it, with a few coyotes and a large dog in hot pursuit. The deer and two of the coyotes continued on toward the darkening storm clouds off to the west, which were approaching at an alarming rate. But one of the coyotes and the dog turned and crossed the line of trees toward us. My grandfather, who walked with a cane due to a disability, told me to get behind him and held up his cane, preparing to fend off a possible attack. But the coyote and the dog just stood there staring at us, not with aggression or with fear, but with an alarmingly calm demeanor. They were perhaps 15 to 20 feet away, certainly close enough to attack if they wanted to, but neither did. They just stood there quietly and stared. and as they did, I felt a sense of calm and protection wash over me. Then, as quickly as they had come, they were gone, running off through the field to catch up with their fellow predators and, hopefully, their prey. Although the memory of that day has never left me, it wasn't until many years later that I really contemplated what that moment had meant to me, what connection had been made, and why. It's possible that the calm and protection I felt resulted simply from my grandfather's presence and nothing more. But since then, I have come to see that moment as my first encounter with Anubis. Why the dog had joined the coyotes, I do not know. Maybe he ran away from a local farm to join them. Maybe it was just a random coincidence. But most domesticated dogs do not mix well with coyotes, so this one must have been roaming the wild for some time. Whatever the reason, the sense of calm and protection that I experienced that day were powerful feelings that I have only ever felt in the presence of the Obsidian Lord. So I can now appreciate that moment for what it was to me. Anubis seeking me out and giving me a little hello years prior to our working together formally. Little did I know then that we would connect about a decade later and establish a deep, personal, lifelong relationship. The beginning. From an early age, I was attuned to the spirits in the world around me. I frequently saw and heard spirits that others could not. I was raised by my grandparents, and my grandfather, although a self-proclaimed Christian, believed firmly in psychic abilities, reincarnation, spirits, and other phenomena with which many modern witches and pagans align. It wasn't until I was older that I really embraced this, but I remember growing up unafraid of the unseen and unknown. I almost became more comfortable with them than I was with people. It was on a summer night in 2001 that I started down the path to being a pagan and a witch. In the house that I grew up in, I sometimes watched TV upstairs in the evening while my grandparents watched it in the living room. While randomly channel surfing, I found a made-for-TV movie called Mists of Avalon. It told the story of King Arthur from the point of view of his sister Morgan, who was a priestess of Avalon, a mysterious holy isle in Britain dedicated to the worship of the Mother Goddess. After watching the movie, I discovered it had been adapted from a book of the same title written by Marion Zimmer Bradley. Being a book lover and an avid reader, I immediately went and got a copy for myself and dove into it. It did not take me long to finish the book, despite it consisting of nearly 1,000 pages of complex plot and a multitude of characters. After reading this highly controversial author, whose work I have since come to reject, I went on to discover other books, like Silver Ravenwolf's Teen Witch, and Scott Cunningham's Wicca, A Guide for the Solitary Practitioner, and its sequel, Living Wicca. This in turn led me to a realization that there are many gods, goddesses, and spirits in the world around us, and that many of them are loving, caring entities. And that realization brought me comfort and solace. As a gay teen, I felt a sense of belonging and understanding that I had never felt in any other spiritual or religious path. It helped me find answers to questions I had been asking about the world around me and its mysteries. It helped me find the true beauty and deep spiritual meaning in the natural world, and it set me on the path to becoming a pagan and a witch. Within the first year of walking this path, I felt a calling to work with a specific deity. I knew there was a spirit out there somewhere who was waiting for me to reach out and make a connection. I did not know who it was at first, but I was okay with that, certain that when the right time came, I would know. As I began to seek out information about the various pantheons of the world, I was first drawn to a particular archetype rather than a specific name or even pantheon. Names like Hades, Pluto, the Morrigan, Hecate, Hel, Osiris, and Anubis jumped out at me, and I began seeing a theme of death and darkness, although I didn't know exactly why I was drawn to this theme. I understood the metaphorical meaning of death at that time, but I didn't really understand how it was relevant in my life, so I approached the theme of death quite literally. I had lost family members by that age, but had never been affected by it in ways that would cause me to reach out to a god of death. Despite that, I trusted my intuition, assuming there was something deeper there, perhaps something related to the transformative meaning of death. I became more and more attracted to the traditions and mythology of ancient Egypt, and eventually focused on Anubis. His energy felt extremely protective to me, full of strength, yet also compassionate. Although most reference books described him as being simply a god of embalming and funerary rites, this made no sense to me. I wasn't ready yet to think about a deity from thousands of years ago and connect it to the modern world. But I decided to investigate further, and this led me to more and more information that confirmed that Anubis was much more complex than I had originally thought. Nearly 2.5 decades later, as I write this book, I now have a deep relationship with Anubis. There have been high points and low points in this relationship, and periods when one or both of us were silent. Life happens. And sometimes circumstances occurred that made me feel less connected to my spiritual path. Nevertheless, our relationship has grown and expanded in ways that I never imagined possible. And although I cannot claim to know all there is to know about Anubis, and with the caveat that it is impossible to know everything there is to know about any deity, I feel that I have enough experience to be able to share what I know about him with you. In fact, I find that the many years during which Anubis has been a part of my spiritual life have left me with a great deal to say about him. I have come to know that he is more than just the Egyptian god of embalming and funerals, and he is more than just a jackal-headed god who lives in the shadows of a far-off desert. I have learned that he is a strong, protective force, one who cares for the souls of both the living and the dead. He protects the marginalized and those in pain. He stands for truth, justice, and integrity. He is supportive, yet also expects you to do the work and be self-sufficient and independent. He values authenticity, integrity, and honesty, yet is also understanding and compassionate. Much of my relationship with Anubis is based on personal experience mixed with the reading and research that I have done over the years. While I do not identify as a Kemetic pagan, one who follows only the spiritual and religious practices of ancient Egypt, often from a reconstructionist point of view, I greatly admire those who do. Although I believe this can be an extremely fulfilling spiritual path for some, however, it is not mine. My approach to my relationship with Anubis, and any deity for that matter, is grounded in my unique experiences in life and my own path as an independent practitioner. Over the years, I have explored many practices from many spiritual paths, and even if I do not incorporate these into my own practice, I always find something of value in them. I align with multiple deities across multiple pantheons. I suppose you could say my practice is eclectic. I call myself a witch and a pagan, but even those words are so broad that it is difficult to fully explain what they mean. My practice is uniquely informed by the things that I have read and done and experienced in life, and I believe that there is power in that. To me, that is what it means to be on a spiritual path. Each of us shapes our own path by the unique experiences we have in life. There is no such thing as cookie-cutter spirituality. Ancient Gods in a Modern World. It is important to remember while listening to this book that we live in a modern world, and we need to see deities through a modern lens. Many, or I dare say most, of those who follow any of the ancient Egyptian deities have no direct connection to the Egypt of old. I have no known Egyptian heritage, nor have I ever lived in Egypt, but that does not invalidate my practice or my experience. Our world is vastly different from the world of 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, and so it is not always relevant to try simply to recreate what was. I cannot relate to Anubis as a god of mummification in a literal sense. In our modern society, we do not mummify our dead or our pets. Although embalming is still a modern practice, it looks quite different from the practices followed thousands of years ago. Nor do we bury our dead in elaborate tombs with their riches. But that does not mean that Anubis is irrelevant to us. There is absolutely a time and a place for continuing these ancient traditions and honoring their prayers, rituals, and practices. But there is also wisdom to be found in discovering how an ancient deity fits into our modern lives. Looking at these traditions and myths from a purely literal perspective is very limiting and misses the entire point of seeking a spiritual connection with a deity. Myths can inform and inspire us, but we must be able to translate them into a context that makes them applicable today if they are to have any meaning for us. Myths can be incredibly interesting, and they can serve as a foundational understanding of a deity, but we must not view them as scripture that must be closely followed. The most important thing about connecting with deities is the experiences you have with them, not my experiences or someone else's, yours and yours alone. Nor does your spiritual relationship with a deity have to align with how it has been viewed historically. I may connect coyotes with Anubis, even though they have not historically been associated with him, although there are species of coyotes found near Egypt. The truth is that your spiritual experiences and mine are all valid. Period. How to use this book. My hope is that in the chapters that follow, you will come to understand a little more about Anubis. My goal is to provide you with information and to act as a guide to get you started building a relationship with him. Although some of what you will find here is based on the historical record, much of it is based on my own experiences. But my experiences with Anubis may not be the same as yours, and that's okay. In fact, that is one of the most beautiful things about deities. Each of us experiences them in different ways. There is no official manual or set of dogmatic rules that you must follow in building any spiritual relationship. Even if you are not a follower of Anubis, I hope this book piques your interest and curiosity. This book consists of two parts. Part 1 contains information on who Anubis is, including his background and his myths, and an overview of the various roles he plays. Part 2 explores how to connect with Anubis and build a deeper relationship with him. The chapters are intended to be listened to in order, as they build on one another and give deeper insights as you move forward. But no matter whether you have worked with Anubis in the past or you are just starting out on your journey, there is something in this book for you. If you are just beginning your journey with Anubis, I welcome you. If you are experienced working with him, you may find that particular chapters interest you more than others. Each chapter concludes with practices and journal prompts that are meant to encourage you to think more deeply about Anubis, the themes related to him, and your growing relationship with him. I strongly encourage you to keep a written record of your thoughts as you progress through the book. I recommend using a notebook dedicated to this practice, but if you already have a notebook that you have dedicated to spiritual exploration, like a book of shadows, then great. Use that. Write out any thoughts that are provoked by the journal prompts so that you have a record of your journey. Take notes as you go along on ideas, correspondences, passages, or names that stand out for you. This will help you along your path. I hope that whoever you are and whatever your reason for listening to this book, you can find something beneficial within. Thank you for embarking on this journey with me. Warmest blessings, Charlie. Part 1. Discovering Anubis. Chapter 1. Who is Anubis? "The truth is harsh," Anubis said. "Spirits come to the Hall of Judgment all the time, and they cannot let go of their lies. They deny their faults, their true feelings, their mistakes, right up until Amit devours their souls for eternity. It takes strength and courage to admit the truth. Rick Riordan, The Cain Chronicles. When you hear the name Anubis, what imagery does it conjure in your mind? Many people are familiar with the name, and perhaps even with the imagery of this popular god. When most think of ancient Egypt, they think of pyramids, deserts, and hieroglyphs. They may think of ancient wisdom shrouded in mystery and secrets buried deep in a far-off land of intense heat, a place where symbols of ancient knowledge are etched on the walls of tombs and temples, lost to time in the desert sands. This mysterious place and its traditions often feel distant and unfamiliar. Many of the portrayals of ancient Egypt found in popular media include some kind of depiction of Anubis, either as a canid, dog-like figure, or a humanoid with the head of a canid. Even those who do not know him by name often immediately recognize him by his image. He can be found in pop culture TV shows like American Gods, one of my favorite fictional representations of him that is based on the book by Neil Gaiman, and Stargate, as well as in movies like Gods of Egypt, The Mummy, The Mummy Returns. His likeness appears in cartoons, video games, card games, and comic books. Anubis is a many-faceted deity. He has been portrayed as a guide, a protector, and a guardian. He is variously known as Lord of Death, Master of Mysteries, Keeper of Keys, and Opener of Ways. He has been called Wise Elder, Master Healer, Chief Embalmer, and Upholder of Truth and Justice. He is recognized as a shaman, a bringer of balance, and a lord of liminal spaces. Of course, most modern portrayals of him are entirely fictional and are often grossly exaggerated fantastical depictions that are loosely based on who he is in reality. Nevertheless, he is recognized by many, even if only by his name and his association with death. One of my favorite metaphysical stores near where I grew up in the Midwest had a 5-foot statue of Anubis in the entrance to their library. He stood, ever watchful, facing the doorway, as if to both welcome visitors and protect the space. I always wished that statue had been for sale, because who doesn't need a life-sized statue of Anubis in their living room? But alas, he was merely there to guide the inquisitive and protect the historical and occult knowledge that lay within. Meet Anubis. Anubis is one of the oldest gods in the Egyptian pantheon, so ancient that evidence indicates that he may predate many other Egyptian deities. Thus, his origins are difficult to pinpoint. Depictions of him in full form date as far back as 3100 BCE, possibly earlier. Moreover, the association between jackals and death dates back even farther than that, perhaps as far back as 6000 BCE. Worship of Anubis predates the worship of Osiris as Lord of Death, as well as the rise in popularity of Osiris and his siblings, Isis, Nephthys, and Set. To the best of our knowledge, Anubis was originally worshipped as the god of the dead and the underworld, and at a significantly earlier date than many other Egyptian gods of the dead. He is sometimes described as the son of Ra, god of the sun, and Heset, a goddess depicted as the cow that gifted milk to humanity, and who is sometimes considered to be an aspect of the great goddess Hathor, mother goddess and goddess of love, fertility, and beauty. In the tales written by Greek philosopher and historian Plutarch, Anubis is described as a son of Nephthys and Osiris, who was raised by Osiris and Isis. We'll revisit this myth in greater detail in Chapter 2. Some alternative myths claim he is the son of Set and Nephthys. Others connect him to the sun, to the earth, to life, and to death, to name just a few of his associations. These conflicting origin stories give some insight into how incredibly complex and influential a deity he is. Most place Anubis's origins in Sinopolis, ancient Greek for city of dogs, which is now the modern-day city of Alkais. Wepwawet, another canid-headed deity, was later associated with Anubis. Wepwawet, usually identified as a wolf, originated in a city then called Lycopolis, ancient Greek for city of wolves. Today.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?